This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Have you ever done something, stopped, and then thought, why the heck did I just do that? The answer is, you didn't. Apparently, it's all your brain's fault.
Just like learning to ride a bike, we can very easily train unhealthy habits into our brain if we're not paying attention to what we're doing.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a teacher from UCLA who's also a psychiatrist about how the brain sometimes goes off on its own and how you can regain control. We'll also spend some time in a special education class in California and spend an academic minute getting older in living color. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When we think about destructive behavior, we think of drug abuse and unhealthy relationships and stuff like that. But what about constantly checking your Twitter feed or obsessing over every detail of your day? Your brain can make you do some odd things. Dr. Rebecca Gladding is an instructor and attending psychiatrist at UCLA. Along with Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, she is the author of You Are Not Your Brain, the four-step solution for changing bad habits, ending unhealthy thinking, and taking control of your life. I spoke with Dr. Gladding about how it seems sometimes your brain can be your worst enemy.
Absolutely. And this is why we wrote the book, is basically to teach people that the brain, through very, you know, sometimes helpful but sometimes unhelpful mechanisms, can work against you. Just like learning to ride a bike, we can very easily train unhealthy habits into our brain if we're not paying attention to what we're doing.
You can't control what you think. How many people have, you know, been at a funeral and just thought of something silly and started laughing? So is there a way to actually train your brain to, you know, okay, stop that, it's time to be serious?
Well, it's a very interesting question. So you are absolutely right. We cannot control the initial thought, impulse, urge that comes up. Absolutely not. That's what's coming from the brain, and this is why we tell people you are not your brain, because the brain is causing these things to bubble up. We do not have control over them. What we do have control over is what we do once the initial thought comes up. Now, granted, starting to laugh uncontrollably is a little different, but say that you had a tendency, a habit to overanalyze everything. If you're able to recognize that initial thought coming up, which we call a deceptive brain message, but if you're able to recognize that initial thought, you can then stop yourself from going down the pattern, the habit of overanalyzing, saying to yourself, well, maybe he meant this, maybe he meant that, but gee, his tone and inflection was like this. That whole subsequent thought process is actually a habit and can be stopped.
And there seems to be a lot of thoughts that really are destructive, thoughts of self-doubt and things like that.
Yes, absolutely. And that's where we came up with a couple of concepts that we hope are very helpful to people, one being true self, which is the idea that you can define your goals and values based on who you are, and the other being the wise advocate, which is really this inner friend, this guide who will make rational, caring, loving decisions on your behalf. And the hardest part is beginning to see that you are doing things that are unhelpful or destructive to yourself. Once you start realizing that these are things that you're doing, you can use something like our four-step method to really start changing your behavior and eventually change your brain.
Could you explain to us the concept of feeding the monster?
Sure. So the idea behind that, it's a catchphrase that we came up with. Basically, the idea is that our brains are set up such that if we pay attention to something and repeat it over and over, we teach the brain that this is an important thing, something we want the brain to pay attention to make a priority, and to repeat whenever possible, whenever a similar situation comes up. So the idea behind feeding the monster is that every time I do that same unhelpful, unhealthy action, I'm telling the brain, hey, make this stronger, make this even more of a priority throughout my life. And so basically the idea of feeding the monster is that you're giving the brain more fuel, so to speak, to continue this habit and make it even stronger.
And some people react poorly to those habits. You had a few case studies in the book which told us of some people who were really destructive.
Absolutely. Most of these things were destructive toward themselves. I mean, we had a performer who had horrendous stage fright and fears of rejection such that he wasn't getting out in his life and following his dreams. We had a woman who was constantly doubting herself to the point that she would get depressed and she would overanalyze every interaction she had, just leading to this incredible exhaustion. a businessman who really saw everyone around him as needy, inept, helpless, things like that, such that he would drink alcohol to distance himself and be able to kind of tune out from people emotionally. Another person who was constantly checking his email because he was afraid his girlfriend was going to leave him, and a couple of women who were worrying about the future in slightly different ways, but one, you know, about her family and another about what her life would be like. Another one we talked about was a woman who was using food to manage her emotions and give her a sense of control. The problem is when you focus attention long enough and you ingrain these behaviors strongly enough into your brain circuitry, the brain will start doing these things automatically. And we call, there's a certain part of the brain called the habit center that really kind of speaks to this, because what happens is, you know, just like if you see a car coming towards you, you swerve automatically, that's mediated by the habit center. The same thing will happen if you are in a situation, say a social situation, where someone says something upsetting to you and you emotionally kind of close down or you start having these negative thoughts and withdraw. You know, we learn some of these patterns of behavior, and if we're not careful, we end up doing things that are very unhelpful to us in the long term.
Well, in the book, you do have the four steps. I call them the four R's.
Uh-huh.
But it seems like the one concept that's around all of them is the concept of mindfulness. Tell us what that means.
Absolutely. So mindfulness is being aware of what's happening as it's happening. It sounds simple, but it's actually relatively hard to put into practice unless you're doing it. The opposite of mindfulness is when you've been listening to a radio station and 5 minutes goes by and you then realize after that 5 minutes, oh, the radio's been going and I really haven't been paying attention. Mindfulness is the opposite of that. It's really being aware of what's happening in your life, what's happening in your body and in your brain in a moment-to-moment way. And so the four steps are really meant to help you learn how to be more aware of what's happening. The first step is relabel, which, as you said, the four R's. The first is relabel, and that's really helping you increase your awareness. So you want to identify what we call deceptive brain messages, but the negative thoughts, impulses, and urges in your head, and you really just want to call them what they are. You can use a simple word or phrase to encapsulate that, but you know, say if you had strong cravings for chocolate, you would just say urge or there's that craving again. Step two, then, is what we call reframe, and it's really asking you to say why these thoughts, urges, and impulses are bothering you, and to help you reevaluate the importance and accuracy of the messages coming from your brain. So an easy way to do this is to say, this is the brain, it's not me that's creating this craving. I mean, it may be coming because I'm bored, I'm trying to avoid something, I'm tired, I'm stressed, but it doesn't mean I have to act on it right now. And then the third step, which is the one that really changes your brain, is called refocus. And the idea behind it is that you direct your attention towards something that's productive and healthy for you, even while these uncomfortable urges and sensations and thoughts are bothering you. And the reason step three is so important is that attention is what changes your brain. So the more you're able to go do something healthy, like take a walk, go visit a friend, whatever it might be, the more you're going to ingrain these healthy, adaptive behaviors into your brain rather than the unhealthy ones that have been impairing you. And then the last step is step four, which is revalue, which really asks you to see clearly that these thoughts, urges, impulses, and desires are false, and they're not representative of you or who you are.
And how long has the research been going on that has come up to these conclusions?
Well, this research has been going on for more than 20 years. Dr. Schwartz, my co-author, started probably in the mid to late 80s working on this because he felt that he wanted to show people that you could change your brain without using medications. And he did a landmark study at UCLA with people with obsessive compulsive disorder and was able to show that the brain changed in very similar ways with medication or with this four-step method.
And how could people recognize some of these behaviors in themselves? Like if somebody is listening to this now and saying, well, that's not me, well, then again, maybe it is. And
right.
It's that indecisive thing we were talking about before. That's it.
Right, right. Well, I mean, there's a couple of ways. I'm sure everyone has had the moment where they just finished doing something and then the thought comes in, why did I just do that? What was I thinking? Clearly, you probably weren't thinking. So that's one way that you can easily identify if you're being caught up in a deceptive brain message. The other is if you really start to define your true goals and values in life, you'll see when you're, you know, straying from those. And so, you know, people can have all kinds of different things. They don't have to be as severe as the things that we were talking about at the beginning, but they could be as simple as, you know, checking your smartphone all the time or over-snacking, holding yourself to really high standards, not saying what you think or you need in your relationships, or just simply avoiding beneficial parts of your life because you're tired, you're anxious, you're fearful, or whatever. So there's a large, you know, range of things. But basically, at the end of the day, if the thoughts, the impulses, the urges are somehow keeping you from doing what you really want to do in life, then you can use the four steps.
Again, the name of Dr. Rebecca Gladding and Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz's book is You Are Not Your Brain, the four-step solution for changing bad habits, ending unhealthy thinking, and taking control of your life. Still to come, teaching can be hard work. Teaching special ed? That's a whole nother story. We'll spend some time with a special ed teacher in California next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1209. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Special education is no stranger to California news. This past winter, a special education teacher in Oakland was accused of beating one of her students. The story got a lot of local media attention. But what about the majority of special education teachers not caught up in litigation, working every day to serve the 10% of all California students in these programs? What's a day like for them? Christine Salakis has some answers.
Stevie Evans has been a special education teacher for 4 years.
I feel like when I first started this job, I was just thrown into the lion's den. They're just like, all right. I mean, I came into teaching through Teach for America, and they really prepare you well for teaching. For a special day class, I don't know if anyone could prepare you for that. I mean, that is just a different ballgame. I just remember going in there and feeling like I had to survive. It was like a matter of me surviving. So it was like, how do I survive? Like, how do I get, you know, the kids to be able to learn?
We're at Elmhurst Community Prep, a small middle school in East Oakland.
Teachers, you wear a different hat all the time. You're, you know, one day you're a teacher, you're a psychologist, you're a police officer, you're a mom. You're a nurse, you're a social worker, you're just like, that's just part of the job.
All right, Trayvon, Johnny, Isaiah, Raheem, Michaela, read them together on three, okay? When I point to them,
all right? I'm gonna do it by myself.
One, two, three.
Navigate.
Required.
Kids come to special education for really diverse reasons. Their challenges can range from autism to severe emotional disturbances. Just within Stevie's class, she has kids with ADHD, auditory and processing deficits, and intellectual disability.
We're like this little dysfunctional family, and sometimes we get along great.
But like, I've got kids who don't have phonemic awareness, which is something you develop in kindergarten. And then I have kids who can read fluently with ease. You know, and at like a fifth grade or a sixth grade text. So they're on radically different reading levels. So I am not going to teach them the same thing, period.
What these kids do have in common is that general education does not quite work for them. And Stevie sees her purpose as leveling the playing field, not just for these kids during school, but for their lives in general.
When I think about how do we change things and how do we empower people and how do we get rid of poverty, I mean, I see education as being number one. Every day I see the work that I do as part of a larger scheme. And although I'm not at the top down, I'm, you know, at the bottom, and I love it. Like, that's where you gotta roll up your sleeves and just get it done. So I see it as part of a larger equation. I'm just one of the important pieces, you know.
Getting this done on a day-to-day can be hard. Special day classes have kids of all ages. Stevie's range from 11 to 15 years old. And on top of this, she's also teaching content from all subjects, content usually taught by five or more different middle school teachers. This changes the nature of Stevie's teaching entirely.
When you hear the word in the video, what are you going to do? Who wants to put their arms up?
Nobody.
Okay, put their arms up. Who wants to pat on the desk?
Nobody.
A huge part of my job is all social, emotional, behavioral. I can't just focus on the academics. It's not what the job entails, you know? It's all encompassing.
And it can produce a chaotic classroom.
Miss Evans, did nobody tell me that we were gonna go on a field trip with the seventh graders?
Who?
The seventh graders.
Who?
The seventh graders.
Go to your center.
Stevie isn't alone in all of this. Special needs teachers often have assistants throughout the day. Here, it's Sherry Jackson. She grew up in the neighborhood around Elmhurst.
I graduated from this school. My whole family didn't grab my kids. Everybody. It's a pretty rough neighborhood.
It's not that there isn't a lot of community here, she says, but there is violence.
You know, the shooting, it's a lot of that that goes around here. The car racing that goes up and down the street. It's just a lot of nonsense, really.
Last year, Oakland's homicide rate was the highest it's been since 2006, more than 130 murders. 18 of those occurred within a mile of Elmhurst Community Prep. 2 occurred within a block of this school of 352 kids.
They might be explosive one day, and I'm like, they're just a hot mess. And then I talk to them, and it's like, well, my uncle got shot yesterday, I'm mad.
And Stevie's class reflects other issues that exist outside of Elmhurst's walls.
In my school now, it's about 70% Latino, 30% African American. But in my class, it's well over 90% African American boys. I mean, there's something wrong with that.
The makeup of Stevie's class is a stark example of a national reality. Black children are more than twice as likely to be identified as having a disability as white students, and they're more than 3 times more likely than all other students to be classified as having mental retardation. This pattern has been observed for decades.
It's not that black boys are just prone to have learning disabilities or dumber than other races. It's like, that's ludicrous. We've already proven that that's not what it is. So what is it then? It's something that's institutionalized and so systematized that people don't see it.
This problem has been discussed by groups ranging from the U.S. Department of Education to the NAACP. In fact, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act now includes a provision which allows the federal government to monitor and manage this over-identification of minority students in special ed. Stevie thinks it's not enough.
You know, it's like, you know that there's injustices in our society, but then you get in someplace that just highlights all of it, and you're just like, whoa.
You might think all these big picture challenges stemming from outside the classroom would encourage these kids to be nice to each other inside. That's not the case. These kids are made fun of a lot outside of class, perhaps for one kid's stutter or how another's eyes look because of fetal alcohol syndrome. As Stevie explains to me, and I see during her class, when these kids are bullied so much, they often become bullies to one another.
We gotta leave.
I don't care. I just don't care. I don't care. I don't need to bother with no little boy like you.
That's just a big part of my job that I didn't really see coming.
Well, I need to buy back. I want you to tell me what to do with yourself.
To deal with all of this, Stevie employs 2 things, a lot of humor and a lot of structure. So while at first she jokes about the rules of her vocabulary exercise...
Who wants to get $1 for it? Ooh. Okay, no, I'm just joking.
No, you're not.
That's not
going to
happen. All right.
She then starts hyper-organizing every piece of the kids' day.
This is Reading Centers. This group is working on, like, decoding and fluency. Those other 2 groups are working on comprehension.
The day is a constant stream of seating assignments, teams, and exercises. There is absolutely no downtime, just high expectations. Even the act of saying good job is turned into something she refers to as a positive reinforcement structure. When the class does something good, like sitting in their seats quietly during a transition, she starts placing individual marbles into a jar.
25, right here. If you don't know one of those words, ask me now, because we're about to play a game.
You have to have a really well-structured environment in order to meet all their needs.
It's amazing because the kids really thrive when there's structure, when there's things that they can count on, when it's really consistent and predictable. It lowers their anxiety. And for kids who have a lot of anxiety for whatever reason, it makes things go a lot smoother when they know exactly what to expect.
Be giving points, but during this time you can earn points or lose points. Go ahead and close your eyes. This is your time to relax your mind.
Even though Stevie got into this work to fight for social justice, she plans to continue teaching for the rest of her life because of a newer passion, her love for her kids.
And take your first really deep breath in. Breathe in.
In East Oakland, I'm Christine Stelakis for Cross Currents.
And breathe out.
This story first ran on the program Cross Currents on KALW in San Francisco. Getting older usually means fading eyesight, but apparently not fading colors. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I am Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. As we age, our vision tends to become less sharp, but color never changes. Sophie Weiriger, researcher in the Department of Psychological Sciences at the University of Liverpool, explains why our perception of color never changes, even as the rods and cones in our eyes degrade.
From our daily experience, we know that colors don't seem to change a lot over our lifespan. This is in fact quite surprising, since when we get older, our lens becomes yellowish and thereby filtering out most of the bluish light, which should indeed affect the way we see colors. To investigate this phenomenon, we recruited 185 participants aged 18 to 75 years of age with normal color vision. We then tested them on two different tasks. In the first task, we measured their color discrimination performance, that is, how well they could discern the difference between two hues. In the second task, we measured how colors appeared to them, that is, we asked them to choose a patch of light that appeared neither red nor green, or neither yellow nor blue. We found that color discrimination performance deteriorates with age, and this decline is most prevalent for yellowish-bluish hues. In contrast, how colors appeared to the observers remained stable, and there was no difference between the young and the old age groups. How does the brain achieve this stable color perception? Researchers have suggested that the brain recalibrates itself across the lifespan by exploiting constants in our visual environment, such as the sky or the sunlight, as an external calibration standard. This would also explain that, lo and behold, different people perceive colors in a similar way, although we now know that the number of light-sensitive red and green receptors in the retina vary significantly between different people.
That was Sophie Weiriger of the University of Liverpool. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.